Have you considered using naltrexone or other medications to curb your alcohol cravings? Even though alcohol use disorder is a legitimate mental health issue, most of us are afraid to discuss our symptoms with our doctor. We worry about being forced into a treatment program or denied other medications we need due to our drinking. And the more we try and fail to change on our own, the more shame and fear we feel, which of course increases our stress and perpetuates the cycle of overdrinking. This can feel like a ticking time bomb that threatens to ruin our health, marriage, and family dynamics. The guilt is overwhelming, yet we have no idea what to do. You already know there is no magic pill. However, there are medications that can help, but you can't get a prescription until you find a doctor you can trust. Allow me to introduce you to Dr. Joshua Lee. He's an MD and the chief clinical advisor at OAR Health, which is a telemedicine platform that provides convenient and private access to naltrexone for anyone suffering with alcohol use disorder. In this episode, you'll learn how naltrexone affects the brain and reduces alcohol cravings, the difference between the Sinclair method and other naltrexone therapies, and success rates for naltrexone, and what to expect if you decide to try it. Dr. Lee is going to explain how you can access naltrexone if you don't want to see your family doctor or file with your insurance. My name is Colleen Cashman. I'm a soberish recovery coach helping high-achieving women get emotionally sober so that drinking less or not at all feels like a superpower. Join me each week for evidence-based, holistic strategies to regulate your brain chemistry and nervous system and also develop a growth mindset so you can feel proud, confident, and resilient with or without a drink in your hand, because it's not about the alcohol. Welcome back to the show, everybody. I'm so glad you're here. And I think you're going to find today's episode highly valuable, if not for you, then maybe somebody else, or just to give you a broader perspective that there are options out there. Alcohol use disorder is a legitimate mental health issue, and we need to treat it with the same broad-based options and compassion that we do other mental health issues. We've come a long way in this culture in terms of destigmatizing mental health issues. It's okay to talk about, you know, bipolar disorder or an ADHD and anxiety and depression, but we have yet to move the needle on alcohol use disorder. We still think that's a you problem, right? There's something wrong with you. And as difficult as COVID was for everybody, you know, the fact that binge drinking rates were up 523% in the moms with small children category. The sheer number of people that are suffering in silence because of the stigma that we attach to alcohol use disorder, the sheer number of people is just simply demanding that we move the needle on alcohol use disorder as well. Because it's totally normal to get addicted to an addictive substance. And as much as I am trying to promote a middle of the road, not black and white strategy, not demonizing alcohol, not demonizing people, like it just is what it is. And, you know, we interact with addictive substances all the time. Our damn phones are addictive, right? Like we have the ability to regulate our behavior, to make choices, to notice when something isn't working and to self-correct. And the fact that sometimes with alcohol, because we do not understand that, you know, what it means to drink responsibly. And during COVID, especially, the rules got changed on us. It used to be where, you know, drinking at home alone means you have a problem. Well, the big alcohol companies had to keep quarter profits up, right? So they flood our social media with, you know, stay home cocktails and memes about everybody drinking on Zoom and, you know, drinking while you work. Like they just changed the rules. And I know for me, when I first had my kids, I would have never with my oldest, I would have never like brought a bottle of wine to a play date or talked about day drinking. And by the time my fourth was born, I mean, we were all drinking throughout the day. Like it just, things have changed and things have shifted. And the fact that so many people have found themselves in a bit of a pickle with alcohol has allowed the sheer number of people to bring to the center where enough of us can call bullshit on the all or nothing, black or white, you're an alcoholic, go directly to AA, do not pass go, do not collect $200, you're never drinking again, get a sponsor and try to figure out what the fuck is wrong with you. Like there's enough of us now that we can, that just by the sheer numbers, it's not a one size fits all answer. And now there's so many people, it's just, it's a creative process. You know, I'm creative in the programs that I'm developing to teach people how to drink mindfully and how to restore alcohol as a pleasure with, so it's no longer a problem. And at the same time, acknowledging alcohol is a drug, not a food group. You know, it's not like how much can I drink to be healthy? It's no, if you want to use this drug, let's use it responsibly to maximize the therapeutic benefits and minimize the bar bill in the morning. Like there's a way to do it and interact with it in the same way that we interact with drugs we get from our doctor and addictive social media and, you know, the chemicals in the food where once you take one bite, you can't stop or whatever the Pringles ad is. Like, we have to learn that we are in control of ourselves and to not be victims or, you know, subconsciously tied to these addictive substances. But it's not just the substances that are the problem. It's also the thinking habits. It's the thinking habits that I can't control myself or that I'm not capable of learning or self-correcting, or that once I've made a mistake with alcohol and allowed myself to get addicted to something because maybe, you know, I just didn't know, like personally, I didn't know alcohol was addictive to people who were normal drinkers. I thought addiction only happened to alcoholics. So there's enough of us now that it's actually nice. I'm sorry for those of you that have had to go through this. I've gone through it, but actually alcohol use disorder is an amazing teacher. It's an amazing teacher. I'm glad I had it. There I said it, because everybody's got something. Everybody is using coping skills to manage their emotions. And until you learn how to manage your emotions, then maybe you're just better at hiding it, but everybody's got something. And some people eat too much, and some people drink too much, and some people please and work too much, and some people spend too much. Like everybody's got the thing. And basically, you're either living in your emotional reaction or you are recovering from one, because there's only one way to learn how to manage your mind, because we're not taught. We're taught to manage our behavior, to be good, to make sure everybody around us approves, to suppress any emotion that might scare someone else or trigger someone else. I mean, all of this stuff is going to have to be walked back. You know, we've raised our own kids that if somebody says something that offends you, that they should stop saying that, and completely miss the fact that we're all responsible for our own emotions. So, long intro, here's what I have to say about today. Naltrexone is an option, and there is no one thing that works. There is no magic pill that solves all the problem. And likewise, there is no magic mindset or perfect strategy to regulate your nervous system. And there is no morning routine that you can do every morning, every day for the rest of your life, and it's going to work. Like all of the strategies, you need all of them. And you need to constantly change your approach, because honestly, the brain likes novelty. But you constantly need to try new things, and you need to pay more attention to your experience in the present moment, because that is your truth, that something is working or something isn't, and less to the ideas that you get attached to in your head that say, I should do this or I shouldn't be feeling this way. Like, we have to just learn to trust ourselves and to trust our bodies and to be able to go with the flow. What we need is constantly changing, which is why the ultimate skill in life is to learn how to live from the inside out, to be more worried about how you feel at any given time and adjusting and knowing and caring for and having compassion for your own body and your own experience than all the rules everybody made up that you're supposed to be following. And then this is different. And now you should pay attention over here. And this is good. And this is bad. And this is right. And this is wrong. Like, the truth is your experience in the present moment. And so, again, there is no one thing that works. You need all the things, and you need to try them in different ratios at all times. So today's episode, I hope that it expands your horizons, if not for you, then for someone that you know, and just that you walk away with an understanding that this is one of the things. This is one of the things that people can do. And now there's a way to do it without doing the walk of shame into your doctor and worrying about your medical records and insurance company. You can do it anonymously from the privacy of your own home. So enjoy the episode. Dr. Lee, I'm excited to have you on the show. I really appreciate you taking the time to be here. Can you do the honors and introduce yourself to the audience? Tell us who you are and what you do.
Yeah, thanks, Colin. Great to be here. I'm Joshua Lee. I'm a professor of population health and medicine at NYU Grossman School of Medicine. I do addiction medicine primarily at a public hospital, Bellevue Hospital in New York City, and do a lot of research and special projects related to addiction. And then I'm also the science advisor at OAR Health. OAR Health is an alcohol treatment app or website, and it is a prescription-based treatment where it's trying to get people naltrexone. Naltrexone is a pretty well-known, or not well-known, we could argue about that, first-line treatment for alcohol use disorder. So it's a pretty simple, generic, safe medication that people often want to try when they're thinking about medications for alcohol treatment.
Is there a connection or a distinguish between the Sinclair method and naltrexone? I hear those two things coupled a lot. Can you explain?
Yeah. I'm not the world expert on Sinclair, but it is based on naltrexone. So naltrexone is a molecule that's related to opioids. It looks a lot like an opioid structurally, like morphine or fentanyl. And it goes to your brain and works where the opiate receptors are, in particular at the mu opiate receptor. There's a couple types of opiate receptors. And a receptor is just kind of a molecule that locks in and gets touched by another molecule. So it's kind of like the button. And if another molecule comes in, that's the finger, it can punch the button. And that's kind of like a neurotransmitter-driven connection in our brain. So the opiate receptors, there's a couple types. And the mu, if you block it, you don't get as much kind of opiate effects or action. And if you stimulate it with another kind of molecule like morphine, you get effects. And so that's one way we use opiates to treat pain. And then it just turns out by luck and evolution that might be where alcohol also has some activity. So alcohol does a lot of things in our brains. Obviously, we can lose our balance. We can pass out. We can just feel kind of loopy. We can also feel like we don't have as much pain or anxiety. And we're high, of course, in terms of euphoria or feeling, you know, good. Some of that can be, for a lot of us that drink, mediated by the opiate receptor. So then if you block that, alcohol doesn't have as much of those effects. And then it can just kind of decrease the reward, the immediate enjoyment, the anticipation of drinking. So with Sinclair, the general idea is to use naltrexone kind of to learn not to get rewarding effects from alcohol, to deliberately kind of take naltrexone before you're going to drink in a kind of immediate pre-drinking dosing. And that's a little different than how we use it in general treatment, where we often just say, this is a new medication. It's kind of a vitamin, an antidepressant, a hypertension medication. Take it every day. We can adjust the dose a little bit and then try and make the changes you're trying to make with drinking. With Sinclair, I think there's more of you're going to start on naltrexone, you're going to take it at this time, and then you actually do want to, I think at least initially, drink. So you'll take naltrexone, then you're going to drink, and then you're going to learn kind of that alcohol doesn't have the power over you, or the medicine will kind of break some of the connections that you were previously struggling with. And it's a way to kind of desensitize yourself to acute effects of alcohol. And that's a way to use naltrexone as opposed to take it every day. So timed or a real kind of only if I'm about to drink use of naltrexone, that generally can be referred to as the Sinclair method. And that's where my kind of expertise ends. I people that follow Sinclair, I think, have a maybe even a more sophisticated or different approach than what I'm describing, but I think that's a general.
So just to repeat back what I'm hearing for clarity, it sounds like the naltrexone is something that you use as needed or as desired, where you're prescribing naltrexone more as a daily medication that's taken almost like a vitamin or whatever. Can you talk a little bit about why you use it that way, the results that you see?
Yeah. I mean, I guess the general sense is people have an alcohol, people that arrive for a treatment episode with heavy alcohol use or an alcohol use disorder generally have a kind of daily struggle or at least multiple days a week. And so you want to kind of protect yourself and be treated ahead of time at all times with naltrexone, much if you have another chronic problem like depression or hypertension. You generally want kind of the help of the medication you've been prescribed all the time, not just occasionally. So that's the idea with naltrexone once a day, to get kind of an adequate level in your body and in your brain of the naltrexone metabolites that are actively blocking the receptor. And then that can help you when you're not drinking, not want to drink. It helps with cravings. It can help you just feel kind of inattentive to drinking, whereas before you might have been kind of obsessed with it. It's, you know, it's getting towards the end of the day. This is when I usually start drinking. It can be hard without any other kind of therapy or intervention to get stuck in that pattern. And then every day becomes the day before and you don't, you know, you don't change your drinking patterns. Whereas this can kind of turn down that volume and you just are less kind of subconsciously or overtly thinking about it. So it's nice to have when you're not drinking. And then if you do drink, which we don't always anticipate when, where, how, but it happens to you and you're in the midst of trying to change your drinking patterns, you may not, if naltrexone's going to work, like it as much, experience the same kind of, that was great, that's tasty. Oh, I really like that, you know, first half of my first drink, that's the best. And you might be more indifferent to it, where you're like, that was okay, but now I kind of feel full and I want to do other stuff tonight. You know, I want to go for a jog still or something like that. So I'm just going to stop drinking here or not drink in the first place. So naltrexone every day just makes it more likely you can make those kinds of in the moment and kind of more deliberate decision makings about avoiding alcohol or drinking less.
How do you see different people react? I mean, I'm assuming almost like any drug or antidepressant or whatever, sometimes there are multiple drugs that you have to try. Personally, I tried naltrexone under the Sinclair method kind of instructions, and I would take it as needed. And it did not get me the results that I wanted in that I didn't, like I quit taking the medication after a while and then still struggled. And then I still see everything on the growth process. I'm sure I learned and it moved me forward. But for me, it wasn't a turning point. And the way I experienced it, of course, not knowing what I'm doing at all, you know, but just taking it as needed. The reason I stopped taking it was because I kind of felt flat. Like I didn't want to keep drinking so much, but I also just didn't want to be like if I was so drinking socially or whatever, I would find that I didn't care. Like I wasn't, I felt flat emotionally and I've had a lot of experiences with antidepressants and stuff too. And so what are your experiences with people responding in different ways?
Yeah, it varies. So number one, I just prescribed it. We're talking a week or two later. Say this is in primary care where I do a lot of this work. Did you even fill the prescription? Take it. Those kind of initial medication, my doctor said, but I'm not sure. You know, like that there's a lot of work there. And there's a pretty significant amount of energy that has to go into just getting someone to have actual on their person the medication. Then when you started it, there can be some common side effects to oral naltrexone, the tablet. And if you take a full or double dose, because sometimes the standard dose is 50 milligrams, which is a standard once a day tablet. But in clinical trials and in regular care, we'll often get to where we want people taking twice that or 100 milligrams a day. If you took that right off the bat and had never taken naltrexone before, that can give you a lot of tummy trouble, kind of nausea. You're on an antibiotic all of a sudden. And so that can be a negative experience. And we want to kind of, we usually now tell people to start with a little like a quarter of a tablet the first time you ever take it. And if that goes okay, you know, later that day, you could take another quarter, or the next day you could take half. So take, you know, go slow and take a couple days to ramp up to 50 milligrams. There's no real rush here. So that can be a conversation. Like, did you experience any of these side effects? We, you know, kind of coach you through that. That can be a barrier to people just getting on it in the first place. But let's say people took it, no side effects, they've been on it. Then it's, doc, this did not cure me. I still drank. Or, hey, I really felt something that was like different for me. You can get this kind of black or white. Was there a change? Did you kind of in the moment that day, that evening, ahead of when you usually were using alcohol, did you experience kind of treatment effect or change or a different version of drinking through use of the naltrexone? And it is not unlike an antidepressant. You know, we usually take a couple months if we put you on an antidepressant to see if we're getting anywhere. And then people can be, yeah, you know, I can't really say that anything's different, or wow, this was a big change. But, you know, the rates are often around 50-50 if people are going to feel something or not. So it's not like a guaranteed treated that infection with penicillin, infection gone. Okay. There are some treatments where we expect a cure and we expect it rapidly. This is a little bit more like antidepressants where we think it's really worth doing, and we have clinical trials that show it's better than placebo. And this is an important problem that deserves treatment like this, but it's not a guaranteed home run in everyone. So then over the first couple months, you're often dealing with, did you get any effects? I got some, I need more. So we might double the dose. Actually, this is a miracle. This, like, I am cured. I feel like on this medication, that's all I'm going to need for now. That can be fun to work with, of course. And naltrexone can do that in some people, just not in all of us. So people's brains work differently. Our molecularly, our receptors are a little bit different from one person to the next. Our relationship to alcohol kind of neurophysiologically is different. Like, you like to drink for 90% those reasons and 10%, you know, in my brain, I'm drinking for 70% that first reason, but then 20% this other 10, you know, it's just, it's really complicated how we all develop our own kind of alcohol problems, if that's what we're trying to treat. And then the kind of response to naltrexone could be quite varied. But again, playing the averages overall, I want everyone to try this medication. And that's in part because I'm like working with a company or that does this, or health will try and get you on naltrexone. But also, this is what I'm doing in primary care when I talk to people with alcohol. We want to try this first because it's pretty low cost and low risk to have people do a kind of treatment trial with naltrexone. It may not work, and there's other stuff we can talk about. And of course, there's all the other kind of world of other therapies, 12-step, other kind of changes you can make in your life, kind of both as part of formal treatment that your insurance might pay for, or just, you know, on your own time. And naltrexone usually doesn't contraindicate or conflict with any of that. It's rarer and rarer that people would go to like an AA meeting and someone would bash any kind of medication treatment. Of course, like, that is part of the legacy of 12-step, like, you know, not even like Prozac, like, you should be off all medications, in part, I think, reflecting a distrust of like the medical establishment and doctors who were not very helpful historically with addiction problems and didn't want to talk to you about your alcohol problem. Like, the last place people could often find help was their regular doctor, who is probably kind of clueless or maybe hostile to the idea. But hopefully with newer generations of doctors, and as we all get kind of more experience, that's changing a little. So naltrexone could be a part of most other things you're doing as part of alcohol treatment. And then that's part of the early conversation. Like, how is it? Yes, naltrexone. Yes, let's try it. Yes, give it a shot. But like, what else are we doing here? Are you still a bartender? Are you still, is your husband still, you know, drinking a 12-pack every night, and that's like part of your, you know, environment that's making it really hard for you to make changes. There's a lot of other stuff that you want to be addressing at the same time, of course.
Well, I have two questions, and you may choose one or the other, they go hand in hand. But first of all, in your experience, can you predict, like, I really think this is going to work well for you versus we're going to give this a shot. You know, you also mentioned that people have different reasons for drinking. You know, as you look at things, when and where do you see naltrexone having the most effect? What demographic or what plans, you know, obviously including other things, when do you see it be the most effective?
We're really not good at predicting that is the bottom line. Okay. And therefore, everyone deserves kind of an equal shot and has about an equal chance of responding to the medication. There was some analysis of early trials from the 90s and 2000s of naltrexone for alcohol that probably reflected the trial design and limitations of the trial versus actual differences. But when I first started prescribing it and doing some research with it, women don't respond as well, or African Americans don't respond as well. That probably was not actually true and was an artifact of studies that didn't adequately kind of sample or recruit enough women or African Americans. And then it was more of a fluke that the numbers of kind of responders didn't look as good in those sub. We've found, I would have no problem, and I would think it's kind of sound science and medicine to prescribe it to anyone, including African American patients, including female versus male. We thought for a second we had a pretty good genetic test actually for response to naltrexone for alcohol use disorder, depending on certain genotypes and certain ways those genes influence our mu opiate receptors. Again, the molecule in our brain that receives opiates and also where alcohol can have activity. But we did a very large trial, and by we, I mean other people, at the University of Pennsylvania a few years ago. It was an important, well-done study, and it didn't show any effect of kind of sorting people out ahead of time based on their genetic markers and a pretty easy-to-do test that could have become like a real personalized medicine story in alcohol treatment. But if we sorted you out by your genes and then randomized people to naltrexone or not, it made no difference. If you had the kind of naltrexone's going to work gene and you got naltrexone, it didn't make any difference next to the group that didn't have that gene and also got naltrexone, and so on and so forth. So it was a really well done study, and I thought very important, and showed that we didn't have much to go on actually in terms of personalized medicine and a genetic test that could predict response. So we don't really know if you show up today for treatment, if it's going to work or not. And we can't really predict based on your drinking history, your family history. You could tell me treatment history that I'm most interested in. Like, I've tried it before, it worked, and then I quit, or something came up, or I've tried this 8 times, it never works. That's, you know, that's obviously, you know, a real kind of like record of how you've done on this particular treatment. But I think that's different than what you're asking. Yeah.
Well, I think you answered it. In general, if somebody gets good results, I heard you say, correct me if I'm wrong, it's about 50-50 if this is going to be something that, you know, ultimately gets you the results you want. Mm-hmm. So, okay, so you're rolling the dice there. You're 1 and 2, and you're doing it. Like, you're happy with the drug. It's either amazing home run, or it's certainly moving you in the right direction. Either way, you're good. How long do you have to take the naltrexone? Is this a lifetime thing? Talk to me about length of treatment.
Great question. It could be in that people could feel they're struggling with or at risk for lapsing to their old patterns for the rest of their life. I mean, we do think of other substance use disorders as being pretty darn chronic, like the amount of time and years people will struggle with cigarette smoking. You know, the amount of times they'll have to quit, pick it back up, quit, pick it back up. You know, that can go on for someone's whole life. We don't think of smoking cessation treatment as lifelong, but people can, for instance, convert to nicotine replacement and stay on that for a long time, like the gum, the patch, or now I vape and I don't smoke. In the opiate world, we certainly think of lifelong treatment with buprenorphine or methadone. If people have switched to a medical opiate to control their opiate use disorder, that can be a lifelong strategy. Now, naltrexone could be the same. It could be something you should take for 10 plus years, never give up. It's certainly going to be available. It's, again, generic, pretty inexpensive, whether you have insurance or not, and something that generally, if you have a prescriber, can stay pretty accessible. Most people, though, will do it for a couple months, and then we may have a unsatisfactory outcome. Like, you're not coming to see me anymore. I don't know what happened to you. It didn't work. I gave up. That doesn't work. I'm still drinking. you know, no thanks, but I'm going to try something else next. Or it worked pretty well. And now I think I'm in a better place and I don't want to continue it lifelong. We usually are trying to encourage people to take it for at least a year. And then if we have people that have done that and had success, then you'll get these kind of long-term converts who really do want it around chronically. They may not take it every day for the rest of their life, but they want it as a kind of available treatment, a little bit like how we'll hoard antibiotics in our medicine cabinet. But in their case, they probably are getting regular refills. They use it regularly, but they may not be taking it every day. So we see kind of naturally, you see all types of combinations, but you can certainly justify taking it for the rest of your life every day. That's quite rare though. And what we're really usually doing month to month in treatment is if it's working, let's not change it, let's keep going. That could become a 5-year treatment episode on naltrexone. Often though, people have gotten to a point where they want to take a pause, and that's fine too. If it's succeeded and their drinking is, you know, in a better place.
So talk to me about how, if somebody was listening, they would go about finding help. You know, you are a primary care physician, but most of us, you know, we don't get to pick a primary care physician with a specialty in addiction. So we're dealing with our primary care doctors.
Yeah.
Is this a conversation we need to be having with the primary care physician, or is this something that we need to be seeking out a specialty?
Yeah, you can do any and all of that. So if you have a regular doctor now, by all means, you know, they should once a year, if you're an adult, ask you about your drinking and, you know, try and respond honestly. And if it's a health concern to you or you know it's a health problem, you know, bring it up. We're not good in primary care at really digging for stuff that you don't screen positive for. So if you don't say in the initial questionnaire or bring it up to the nurse or doctor or PA, like whoever you see in the first 5 minutes.
Right.
And then if you don't like ever bring it up with this doctor, that we generally won't ever come back to it or be like, oh, wait a minute. I have a sense here that you have an alcohol problem. So, you know, now that we're 17 minutes into this visit, let's make sure that this is not a thing. You know, it'll just get glossed over, missed. People work, are busy, and you'll lose the chance to talk to that team about that problem. So there is some kind of, can you at least answer the question appropriately, or at least say, yes, I drink too much sometimes, yes, I might have a problem, like these kind of screening questions, or bring it up if it's just a frank concern and you're like, and I want a thing of naltrexone. So then your doctor may or may not be able to help you with that. That may be a new one for them. You may get the, absolutely, I would love to help you with that. You could just as often get the, I'm not sure what you're talking about. I don't think we do that here. So it can be a real mix, obviously, and not all the doctors should get it right and they won't, which is, oh, you are screening, you know, let me ask you a few more questions, non-judgmentally and in a way that's going to strengthen our relationship. But now we're finally going to talk about alcohol. You do meet criteria for an alcohol use disorder. This is a really easy to try treatment. There's other stuff we can try. Are you interested in any of them? If you're interested in this treatment, here's a prescription in an hour. You know, it's ready for you at Walgreens. That's how it should go. And it won't for a lot of people because doctors aren't educated. They're not up to date. They're too busy. Some just have a stigma and don't see it as something they want to talk to their patients about, kind of like other stigmatized conditions where they just may feel inadequate and uninterested. So what we've done with OR Health, that's orhealth.com. So you could Google OR, you could Google naltrexone, but you'll see some online providers or some of our competitors that would love to send you a prescription by mail. And that's what we do with that product. It's really saying you may not have a doctor, you may not get to them this year. And if you do, they may not know what they're doing, or you may not bring it up. In which case you can just do this directly through essentially a app-based prescription provider. That'll also do, through a telehealth relationship, all the same questionnaires, make a similar diagnosis, and recommend treatment. And with OR, you're just going to get naltrexone. We're not like a bigger kind of scope of practice where we're also going to treat your depression or your struggle with diet and exercise, or, you know, it's not like seeing your primary care doctor at all, but it is going to give you really quick, reliable access to naltrexone because you already know that you're interested in it or want some type of treatment like that for an alcohol use disorder. And in 99% of people with an alcohol use disorder, you can safely try naltrexone. And that's what that kind of service is doing. So whether you're getting it brick and mortar, whether you get it, you know, through these more kind of telehealth internet apps is up to you, or depending on kind of how you come to it.
Well, that's amazing. And what I'd like to ask you is kind of a fun question, because I know as a woman who struggled with alcohol use disorder for years, how much do you drink? I drink 2 to 3 drinks 2 to 3 times a week. That was my pat answer. There's no freaking way I was saying more than that because I didn't want to get flagged. Can you just maybe eliminate some of the emotional inflammation about what it means to tell your doctor? You know, I guess I assumed that it would get written down in my chart and that I would be labeled as an alcoholic, or, and it would somehow be able to bite me in the ass with my career or if I'm going through a divorce. You know, I was afraid to tell my doctor. Can you speak to that just as a general physician, what it means to pull your big girl panties up and tell the truth about how much alcohol you're drinking?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very common reason not to bring it up. That I know of, there's no historical discrimination that could happen to you or no kind of legal jeopardy. But I'm also not a lawyer and couldn't tell you that for sure. Other than, and, you know, we can bring up all manner of sensitive, potentially, you know, damaging information to our reputation, to our marriage, what have you, in an encounter with a healthcare provider. That's why we have confidentiality. And, you know, it's really, it's kind of existential to the whole thing that no one else can hear about that, including, you know, you can't go around subpoenaing people's medical records in terms of just cause. I mean, if you're arguing about a kind of medical malpractice, then the medical records are kind of the source of the dispute. But if it's just that I told my doctor once that I smoke or had an abortion or am cheating on my spouse, like that could never come out. But you have to trust in the healthcare kind of industry and that physician or other providers kind of level of information security and record keeping that it would not abuse your trust. But it's not probably unlike telling all that to a lawyer. They're similar in that they're supposed to be that client attorney kind of sacred confidentiality. That's all I could say there. Now, if there's a lot of claims in your chart for this or that problem, your health insurer certainly knows that. So that we know of, that's not a condition that will lead to kind of health insurance discrimination. But I'm also not confident to say that's never happened, et cetera, et cetera. There are some like very strict confidentiality rules around licensed drug and alcohol treatment for exactly these types of reasons, where if people went to a methadone clinic or a drug and alcohol outpatient program, they knew that kind of the rest of healthcare, if they saw those records, would discriminate against them. Historically, there was some basis for that. And so those records were kind of locked away from the rest of your medical record. If you think about working like in a big health system like I do, I can't see everybody. And like therapy notes are classically off limits. So I'm a doctor, I'm seeing you for hypertension. You also get psychotherapy for your bipolar disorder over at the mental health clinic. I'm usually not able to just start reading all your therapy notes because of those similar kind of privacy and confidentiality concerns. So I would say it's not a reason not to get help.
Yeah.
The worst thing you can do is not get help, you know, if you would like it and need it.
Would you be able to request your doctor not write that down? Is that something, you know, because especially if it does go into a system where, okay, now all your doctors in this network, you know, your hormone doctor and your gynecologist and all that, like now everybody's going to see that I just said that. Can you, if you have a doctor you want to talk to, can you request that it not be noted in the chart and start the conversation that way? Is that something doctors would be willing to do?
Absolutely. I don't know what their individual response would be. It would be hard for me just in my health system to start prescribing you naltrexone just because there's, you know, if I'm going to treat something, there's a reason for it. Now, if you want to tell me about alcohol and then we're just going to keep talking about it, I can write something in the chart that's pretty benign. Like, we discussed this, that, and the other, and we'll follow up next month about it. If it is triggering other diagnostics, treatments, you're going to go to rehab somewhere, like, the secret will be out at some point, you know, in terms of getting real treatment for that. But I think that's honestly one of the reasons why our product at OAR Health has had any success, is that people are really sensitive to those issues. And it's just a lot of work and a lot of preparing yourself and a lot of uncertainty. And people can get scared by that in terms of, okay, I'm really going to go tell Dr. Phil about this today. Like, he's known me for 10 years. I've never brought it up. It kind of means I haven't been telling the truth up until this point. And that's, in a sense, an opportunity for a product like OARS and naltrexone through mail that is not linked to your health record. Yeah. Because we're not integrated with your doctor's office. We don't accept insurance. It's going to be out of pocket at, we think, a reasonable cost. But this is a, basically, you're kind of getting, you're going to Walgreens and you're buying something over the counter, and no one else is going to know about it unless you want to tell them about it.
Okay. That's amazing. So that's OAR Health. And I want to note that I can see that OAR, where I, when you first said it, I don't know why I thought it was ORR, but it's OAR.
Good, as in good point. OAR. Yeah. Yeah. Kind of like you're adrift and then you get an OAR and now you can kind of steer the boat, but good point. OAR Health.
Is there anything I haven't asked you that comes to mind that would be helpful to, you know, the women in my community?
Yeah, we know now that really prior to COVID, women were catching up with men in terms of like drinking rates, harms from drinking. Men on average still drink more, have more problems from alcohol, but women, it's been getting worse in American women. COVID was, I think, particularly a setback, really for everyone, but for adult women in terms of heavier drinking rates, more harm related to drinking, otherwise healthy women suddenly having a liver failure, you know, quite dramatic, deadly consequences, and probably haven't had enough women get the help that they need at the same time. So we're kind of living in and seeing kind of created in our midst a real kind of epidemic and crisis of overuse of alcohol in adult women in the United States. And that is like a real public health concern. Women on average, as they get older, are healthier than men, just kind of on average. But this is kind of narrowing that gap where women are, in a sense, becoming less healthy and as unhealthy as men of their age group because of activity like overuse of alcohol. So we really want to respond to that. We need to kind of, not just me personally, but or anything I'm working on, but as a country, figure out a kind of different educational, public health, public awareness, marketing.
Yeah, that's no why marketing. I'm out like, here marketing. It's not about the alcohol. We're normalizing this. You know, I've seen a stat, something like 523% increase in moms with kids of heavy binge drinking episodes, which is anything over 0.08. And it's whoa. And what's been out there is the shame and the shame and the stigma. Yep. You can't talk to your doctor. And there's a binary solution. You're black or white. You're an alcoholic. Do not pass go. Go directly to AA for the rest of your life. You can never drink again. And I've been there. And there's just so many paths out. But finding a way to talk to somebody about it is, I know for me, I was shocked on the day I did. I finally let the secret out and I had no trouble after that, like sticking with my goals or whatever, because I had just been so unseen. And so like my goal, why I get up in the morning is I want people to know they're not alone.
Yeah.
This is fixable. There's a lot of options. And I love that your option is kind of anonymous and it's something you can try. And so I appreciate you being here to share this information and also the fact that you exist and that you are, there's a company that's doing this.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it clicks with your experience, not on naltrexone necessarily, but like it's this kind of growing awareness in our field that we have to act now and help people out that traditionally were not a focus of alcohol interventions, not what your doctor thinks. Your doctor doesn't kind of realize or know yet or think about the, you know, 50-year-old woman with kids as his, this is the person I need to make sure, you know, doesn't have a drinking problem, or if they do, offer help to.
I think the belief that this is fixable, this isn't a lifelong affliction, that there's something wrong with you, that if you get support and you ask for help, that something will work. And maybe not one thing, maybe three things, and then maybe that changes. But I think just seeing that there's help and options out there will give people the courage to try. So
yeah, we hope so.
Yeah, I really appreciate you being here, Dr. Lee.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Thank you for listening. That's it for this week's episode. If you liked this content or you know someone who needs to listen to it, please share this episode. Either text a link to a friend or share it on your socials. Because even if you are not needing or interested in trying naltrexone, can you imagine the person out there who is just waiting for this sort of option? I know I would have done anything for this when I was looking for naltrexone. And as it was, I was married to a doctor and was able to get it that way. But I don't think I would have ever gone to my normal doctor, you know? So even if you've gone through and you've made it to the other side, be thinking of how you can share this so that other people have access to shame-free options, so that they can make a decision for themselves about whether or not to seek help or medication for alcohol use disorder. And I will talk about sharing. You know, I talk with my clients every week and I'm really working hard. You know, I've moved away from the sobriety because I'm not teaching sobriety. I'm teaching emotional sobriety and I teach mindful drinking in the next chapter. And yet still there's such stigma around admitting to the fact that you're a little in the weeds with alcohol, that you're dependent or you drink more than you should, or that you wish you drank less, like all of these things. And as you heal, you got to leave the light on at the end of the tunnel for other people, you know, and that is where sharing my show, yes, it's called It's Not About the Alcohol. So one might wonder if it has something to do with alcohol, even though I'm very clear this doesn't have anything to do with alcohol. But even if it is obvious that, you know, hey, I did get in the weeds with alcohol. Like, it is a sign of resilience and having moved through your issue that you have the ability to smile and share with other people and say, yeah, I've been there and it's going to be okay. There's so much hope. I can help you. We have to move the needle on the stigma where once you have a drinking problem, that means for the rest of your life, people wonder if you're an alcoholic. That's bullshit. It's not. You can get addicted to alcohol, coffee, cigarettes, Netflix, TikTok, like all of the things. Like, I think I'm struggling with a TikTok addiction right now. I'm gonna be honest. Like, I notice my brain is getting crazy checking my views or whatever. And you know what? I've gotten over addictions before. I know how to get out of it. Like, I recognize the symptoms earlier and earlier. Like, hey, what once felt good is not feeling as good, and yet I'm doing it more and more and more. Like, the more you realize that getting out of the weeds with addictive substance is just a skill, you just need awareness and mindfulness and, you know, being able to ask the right questions. What do I need to do different? You know, the more you're able to do that in your own life, the more you're obligated to share your struggles with other people in some way. Leave a footprint, leave a sign so that other people can follow your breadcrumbs. I know that's a lot of analogies, but it's very important to be willing to speak up because there are so many other people suffering in darkness. You know, COVID, that made everybody on the drinking scale, you know, alcohol use disorder, it's a spectrum, right? Everybody that's a regular drinker is on it, period. And all the regular drinkers took big old steps down the spectrum because drinking was normalized differently. You don't have to go out and be social anymore. Now you can just drink at home. And I talk to women every single day that are suffering in silence and shame. And the more of us that can stand here and hold the space for our sisters and say, yeah, happened to me too. And it's going to be okay. Like, it's gonna be okay. Stop hiding in shame. Your secrets make you sick. So if you think this episode could help someone, please share it. Pull your big girl panties up. It's not about the alcohol. This week it's about naltrexone, but share it. Be that person who opens the door for somebody else or holds the door for somebody else. And so that's it. The only other thing I'll mention is that next week I have a fabulous interview. I haven't processed it or titled it yet, but you are going to hear an amazing story of one woman's journey through grief. She lost her sister to a drunk driving accident and then had such post-traumatic stress disorder that, spoiler alert, she ends up in a wheelchair and wearing a helmet because she has seizures all day long. And the journey she had, her road to recovery after going to so many doctors and medications and searching for traditional solutions, she finally found something called rapid resolution therapy, which is a bit of an energy healing and also some cognitive work. But the story is fascinating. The therapy is fascinating. And you absolutely will not want to miss this interview. So that will be up next week. And then if you are at all curious about what it would be like to work with me, I do a free discovery call to explain what the next chapter is. You would walk away from that call. It is not a high pressure sale. You would walk away from the call with a very clear understanding of where you're at and what really needs to change to move through the alcohol use disorder so that you can feel confident with or without a drink in your hand and know that this is not about the alcohol. You will walk away from that call with a clear bridge and a step-by-step process that you need to go through, whether it's with me or on your own or somebody else. And I love chatting with people and I love giving them the gift of clarity and vision. And so if you're at all interested, get in the show notes, click the link, book a discovery call. And either way, I'll see you back here next week.